first impressions aren't the most important thing. They're the only thing. At Ernie's Print Shop, we'll produce what you need to represent your company professionally. Right now, you can get 1,000 full-color business cards, 1,000 4x6 postcards, or a 3x5 banner for just $60. You choose. Check us out at erniesprintshop.com. Ernie's Print Shop. Over 50 years, one source, one solution. erniesprintshop.com. 502-969-8585.
Being a victim of crime is no joke, but you do have options that can help you avoid becoming a victim. I'm Ed Springson of the My View Matters radio show, and on behalf of myself and co-host Ed Martin, I urge each of you to help us fight against crime. You can do your part by calling Crime Stoppers at 582-CLUE. Since 1982, Crime Stoppers has helped get over 23,000 criminals off the street with your help. Working together, we can make a difference to take our streets back. Please call Crime Stoppers at 582-CLUE, or you can visit them online at www.582clue.com. Remember, Crime Stoppers always offers up to a $1,000 reward. Get involved and help make a positive change in your neighborhood. Thanks.
Advertisers, here's a great way to reach a quality audience. Get heard on My View Matters and make some noise in the marketplace.
Email myviewmatters@aol.com for advertising opportunities. Make a sound investment.
So, I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, "I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore!"
I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth. You can't handle the truth.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome again to another weekly episode of the TNT Radio Show.
Tuesday Night Truth here on the My View Matters radio network. It's good to have you back on with us tonight. Looking at the Freedom Calendar, right, and it says that today is Tuesday, August the 5th. Hard to believe it. We're already into August. Tuesday, August the 5th. And not a lot as far as this week in history. I know that is one of our favorite features here. We do see on the calendar that this week in 1786, the first standard set for gold in 1786 this week, first standard set for gold. So that being said, we'll move right into the important news of the evening and of the week. And this past weekend, we had Fancy Farm out in western Kentucky. If any of you all have not been to Fancy Farm, and we know thousands of people have, but for those out of state or maybe haven't had the opportunity, Fancy Farm is this little picnic that they have out there. And this thing goes all the way back to the 1800s, where politicians will go out there on the stump, if you will, and give political speeches. And it's supposedly the world's largest one-day barbecue, and it was just held this past weekend on the 2nd. And it's a traditional political gathering spot, and you'll have local and state political candidates come out there, and occasionally national political candidates will come out there. And this is a site going all the way back to 1880 on the grounds of the elementary school there and also the neighboring Catholic church there. And it really wasn't much of an event, much of a big to-do, if you will, until around 1931 when former governor, best known for being the commissioner of Major League Baseball at one point, Happy Chandler, began making appearances at that 1931 appearance when running for lieutenant governor. So many Kentucky politicians now attend that it tends to be only news if a major politician does not attend, such as Jim Bunning. He didn't show up in 2007. That was right before Mitch McConnell kind of bullied him into retiring. And you've had national figures show up and make speeches, such as over the years, George Wallace, Al Gore, and Vice President Alvin Barkley spoke many times. So bringing it up to this past weekend, I'll read to you all the summary that I gave to people out on the social networks about what I thought about this event. And I did not go all the way out to Western Kentucky for it this year. I saved my time and money and gas. It's very hot, and it's a big event. It takes all day long, and it takes away from what would be my normal work schedule. So it wasn't really conducive to that. But my summary of a very anticlimactic Fancy Farm 2014, if you will, we had a show that began with the MC was threatening police state action against those who jeered too loudly. We had Todd Hollenbach and Adam Edlin, who appeared to be auditioning for the best used car salesman in the Democratic Party of Kentucky. Had a kind of a bizarre speech with Charles Hatchett, and maybe he was trying to get attention with it, but it really probably turned some people off. He started talking about the Founding Fathers, which is great, but he's kind of a local perennial candidate. Nothing against perennial candidates, like Gateway Galbraith usually said. He was a perennial candidate because we had perennial problems in the state. But Charles Hatchett was running for Congress down there in the 1st District, he being the winner of the Democratic primary. And, of course, he's taking on one of these big incumbents who have been in there forever, and that is 1st District Congressman Republican Ed Whitfield. And Hatchett won a primary, a Democratic primary, with about 55% of the vote. And he gave a speech that was kind of out there and I guess was too serious or too intense or too heavy for what is normally just like a little pep rally. I think they want you to keep it dumbed down to sound bites, and they like when people yell out repetitive things, and the frat boys are always there for the Republican Party, and the unions are always there for the Democrat Party, and they'll go back and forth with their little slogans and their little chants. And it's pretty much like a pep rally for a sporting event. So I guess to these people, it was similar to if you went to a football game and at halftime someone gave a big theological or philosophical speech. It would go over like a lead balloon. So Hatchett may actually be more constitutional than his opponent, Ed Whitfield. But his bizarre speech showed why he probably will not win elected office. But I think it's very important, if I can pull up the Campaign for Liberty webpage while I'm sitting here, to explain to you that most all candidates were sent a survey from the Campaign of Liberty. Hell, a lot of surveys were sent from all kinds of groups. The Campaign for Liberty is a group near and dear to my heart, and I thought it was interesting that when receiving this survey, all the way back in the primary, you have a Democrat candidate for House in the first district, Mr. Charles Hatchett, who actually agreed, in theory, in survey, agreed with 17 of the 20 issues that the Campaign for Liberty put out there. And I want to pull them up just to give you an idea what I'm talking about so you don't think I'm just coming out of left field, no pun intended, telling you that this guy is more constitutional than his Republican incumbent opponent, Mr. Ed Whitfield. And the reason I say that, I now have the Kentucky Campaign for Liberty survey up here, and I will tell you all the things on which the Democratic candidate agreed with the Campaign for Liberty. Like I said, I did my research, and this guy agreed with the Campaign for Liberty on 17 out of 20 issues. He answered yes to the following questions. Will you co-sponsor and support efforts for roll call votes on an audit the Fed bill? I'll make sure I get all the right answers here for Mr. Charles Hatfield. He said yes to that. Will you support legislation that will remove capital gains and sales taxes on gold and silver coinage? He said yes to that as well. Will you vote to oppose legislation that will allow the federal government to prohibit the sale, use, or carry of your firearms? He said yes to that as well. Will you support ending all foreign aid? He said yes. So we're going along with stuff that you normally don't hear any candidate, much less a Democratic candidate, say. And I just thought it would be fair to mention this here, especially after his speech. It probably didn't go over too well in the equivalent of a high school pep rally. So continuing on, I'm going to give you a few more of these things where Charles Hatchett agreed with the Kentucky Campaign for Liberty. He agreed that he would support and vote to protect states asserting their rights under the 10th Amendment. He agreed that he would co-sponsor legislation such as the American Sovereignty Restoration Act to withdraw the United States from the United Nations. He agreed that he would support legislation that would shut down the Transportation Security Administration, TSA, and put airport security back into private hands. He also agreed to oppose using military force without a declaration of war. So I'm saying all this stuff. No one expects this guy to have a chance against big incumbent Ed Whitfield. But you know what? Ed Whitfield didn't fill out the survey. And unfortunately, this guy gave a speech that was probably too serious. And he did start talking about the Founding Fathers, which probably scared a lot of frat boys and union members. Probably turned off some people. Now, Rand Paul delivered possibly the worst speech that I have ever heard him give. And it's sad because you take a man like Rand Paul, who has this normal exemplary vernacular, and it's dumbed down to the point of playing Glee Club captain for Mitch McConnell. It was kind of like watching Bobby Fischer play checkers instead of chess. You can say it's an insult to Rand Paul when you get out there and give a limerick about McConnell's opponent. That didn't do a lot for me. Of course, Rand Paul has no idea who his opponent's going to be for U.S. Senate and or for certain who is maybe for U.S. President. So moving on to Mitch McConnell. Now, McConnell's speech was more of the same boring rhetoric, probably even less enthusiastic than previous endeavors. His exhausted tone suggested that he had succumbed to his future as a lobbyist. We know he lives right down there by K Street and all the lobbyists in Washington, D.C. God forbid you ever catch him in Kentucky. It must be a campaign season. And finally, that brings us to Jamie Comer, Agriculture Commissioner James Comer, in his official announcement for governor. He gave the best performance of the day, and it was insightful, professional, and it was dignified. I would say the only bad news about who was not allowed to speak is it would have been nice to have seen some third party or independent or write-in candidates allowed to speak. And I know that sounds crazy for those who believe in the Uniparty, which is the Democratic and Republican side of the same one Uniparty coin. They call themselves the right and the left, which is just a false paradigm. But had there been independent candidates like David Patterson, Libertarian candidate for U.S. Senate, or if there had been third party or write-in candidates, then maybe the event might have proven more entertaining and more issue-driven. We're going to see if we can pull up any of James Comer's speech, because it was pretty much the only one that had any substance to it. And I know people are afraid. I've heard people saying out on the social networks now that they're afraid that it won't take long for the party to corrupt Mr. Comer. And they use, for example, what we've seen happen with Rand Paul lately. And I've been very clear. We were friendly with Rand Paul and the Paul family back a decade ago when most people didn't know who he was. Most people didn't even know he was an eye doctor in Western Kentucky. Back when the folks at Take Back Kentucky, we were trying to get him to run for office. And I truly believe that Jamie Comer will be kind of the future of what we're looking for in this state. Just going to see if we can find some video, at least audio, to play of his speech, but it doesn't look like it's coming up, so that's okay. I mean, Comer was, again, the only one that gave us anything of substance. And I'm hoping that the Republican Party on the state level will not suck the life out of him, too. I'm hoping that does not happen. So that's pretty much our comments on Fancy Farm. We'll get back into our regular show prep here. We will segue from the small town of Fancy Farm, Kentucky, out in western Kentucky, to another small town all the way up in Michigan. And this story comes to us from Reason Magazine. It's entitled, Meet a Town That's Had Enough of Militarized Policing. The township of Barry, Michigan, with a very small population of 4,000, the town of Barry, Michigan, has four full-time police officers, four part-time police officers, two Humvees, and also two armored personnel carriers, free, of course, courtesy of the Defense Department's program. Until recently, Barry Township, Michigan, had about three dozen unpaid but armed reserve police officers that would patrol the streets. And all these cops need to find something to do with themselves. And many of the people of Barry Township are more than a bit bent out of shape. They've been on the receiving end of something. What I mean by that is L.L. Brazier writes in the Detroit Free Press this past May the 10th, Jack Nedernick stepped behind Two Jacks Tavern, the bar and restaurant he has owned for 30 years in this small western Michigan town. Now, Mr. Navernick was out drinking with his friends for his 58th birthday, and he happened to walk back behind the bar, and he kind of decided to relieve himself, had to urinate in a little empty corner of the bar by the parking lot because the bar was locked up. Keep in mind, he owns the bar for 30 years, okay? Within seconds of the man urinating behind his own building that he's owned for 30 years, within seconds of Mr. Nadernick doing this in the little town of Barry Township, Michigan, two police cars and three officers, two of them unpaid reserves, confronted him as he was zipping up his pants. Now, what has happened after that is up for debate, and you can believe what you want, because the police say that he resisted arrest. He says he did not resist arrest, and there was another eyewitness who said that he did not. What everyone does agree on is the aftermath. Never can a broken hand from a police baton, bloody elbows, and knees in his back. He was handcuffed, jailed, put in a cage, and charged with disorderly conduct and resisting arrest. A felony, which could carry 2 years. Now, if this was just a one-off incident, Nabernick's friends would be bent out of shape and his lawyer would be prepping a lawsuit. But this is only one high-profile incident in a small town where people complain the cops are out of control. And we've talked about out-of-control cops on this show many a times. And we know that there's police officers around here who get pissed off when we talk about this. Well, they're just going to have to suck it up and deal with it. It's not an isolated incident in this town of Berry Township, Michigan. Police Chief Victor Pierce justifies his paramilitary machine on the grounds of, quote, terrorism, barricaded gunmen, and mass shootings. Oh, yeah, and God. What do I mean when I say in God? Because the police chief told the township board that he has preached a vision and that the Lord has put him here for a reason. So apparently the police chief believes that God put him here to abuse the citizens. Well, the township's insurance company finally forced the police chief to make his small army of renegade cops stand down and confine themselves to special events. After a packed town meeting, this is back in May. Story just came out a few minutes ago, maybe a couple hours ago from Reason Magazine, but this happened back in May, where they had a packed town meeting, and it had to be moved to a high school to accommodate all the people who wanted to attend the meeting. And at this meeting, the township board unanimously voted to review Pierce's continued employment in a special meeting. And a notice of the meeting occupied the township website's entire front page. So we could say this is one small step in rolling back the militarization of modern police force. Or we could say it's just the latest bit of evidence that law enforcement in the United States has gone full batshit crazy. And they've gone into full-on occupying enemy territory mode. So we're still waiting to hear. This is going back a couple of months where this meeting keeps getting delayed and rescheduled because of public notice requirements. But remember, this is a small town of about 4,000 people. When they have about 36, if you're to believe the number of three dozen, about 36 unpaid but armed reserve police officers. Why do you need 36 unpaid armed police officers for a town of 4,000. It doesn't make a lot of sense, and then they've got to find something to do with themselves. So there you go. I thought it was a good story to start with tonight because it's a small little town. How when a cop wants to harass you about urinating on the side of your own building that you owned for 30 years. And within seconds, you had these two cop cars and three officers confronting him. We always hear that when seconds count, cops are only minutes away. So I guess when a fake crime occurs, fake cops are only seconds away, right? And this police chief, or the sheriff, says that the Lord put him here for this reason. So apparently he was put here to demonstrate how ridiculous and how dangerous that these strident, quote, defenders of law and order can be, that they are really empire builders on the taxpayer dime. It sounds like something you'd see on the Comedy Central Network with Reno 911, but apparently it's real life. And I think this should be another argument for keeping government as small as possible. Contrast this with what it would have taken to get the head of the DEA fired. I'll give you a hint. It's not possible. Now, if the head of DEA were to do something that went against the police state, like legalization or decriminalization of marijuana, then they might get them fired. But why is it that you have a town here? Again, I was reading the township, and then within the town is an even smaller town. Why is it you have police officers to the degree of one police officer for every 60 to 100 people? Is that average? Is that on scale? I don't know. But I will say this again. I think it's an argument for keeping government as small as possible. Maybe keep the volunteers and let the paid police go. Maybe that's the problem. Maybe if the terrorists are coming after the good citizens of Perry Township, Michigan, then that means that maybe ISIS has already overrun the rest of the country before they ever get to this small town. But you see, when locally elected government works properly, it can be wonderful. Unfortunately, it's very vulnerable to this kind of person who probably ran for class president in high school, but has no measurable administrative ability and zero sense. I mean, they caught the guy pulling his zipper up after urinating, and he was handcuffed, put in a cage, and charged with disorderly conduct and resisting arrest, equaling up to a 2-year felony. I'm guessing if they could, and if they thought they might get away with it, maybe they would have put him on the sex offender registry too. Because they could have said it was indecent exposure. Then they could have called him a sex crime as well, couldn't they? I mean, I understand people might say way out there on the edge of sanity, people might say, well, why in the world is that 58-year-old man getting drunk and stupid with his buddies where he's got to urinate in a parking lot? Again, it was his building. It was late at night. He was in the corner of the building in the parking lot. Yes, he was urinating. So if people want to get caught up on that, that's fine. I think it's irrelevant. I think it's none of my business if he takes a leak in his own parking lot. Or I think it's also, more importantly, most importantly, nor is it the business at all of a police force that views us, the people, we the people, as the enemy combatants. Because I know, I sure know that when a guy is urinating on the side of his own building late at night, it makes me feel much safer, much more safe, when they give him a broken hand from a police baton, bloody elbows, and they knee him in the back. Think about that for a minute. You're listening to the TNT radio show, Tuesday Night Truth. Didn't think I would do that since we've been doing this on Tuesday nights for a few months. TNT Radio, Tuesday Night Truth. Under My View Matters Radio Network, and we'll be back.
entitled.
You want answers.
I want the truth. You can't handle the truth.
And we're back, and we thank you for sticking with us here on the TNT Radio Show, Tuesday Night Truth, on the My View Matters Radio Network. And we were talking about a police force in the very small town of Berry Township, Michigan, before we went to the break. And we were talking about police forces being out of control. And sticking with that topic, we now want to bring up a story that was brought to my attention over at the freethoughtproject.com. This is a good organization, and I can see at the top of their page they honor Nikola Tesla and Henry David Thoreau, so they can't be too bad. And this is a story about an ex-police sergeant who tells why and how you should fight all speeding tickets. And this story, again, originated over this past weekend, and it says, "Hello, my name is Stan, a retired sergeant of the police force for 14 years. I also was a police prosecutor at times, so I know what I am talking about. I spent half my life in magistrate's courts during my time in the police force. I was only ever a very fair policeman, and I am very proud of my time in the job, looking after the interests of citizens, often to the detriment of my family and my health." He says, "I never booked any driver for a trifling offense ever. People committing trifling offenses," which he doesn't really define, I'd like to know what that means, trifling offense, "commonly used to get a warning and a vehicle check. It had to be a serious matter before I booked anyone. And I am so annoyed at what is happening now these days in what I call indiscriminate revenue gathering among police departments." And this former police sergeant says that it's absolutely disgusting to him, that the government and the police force need to hang their heads in shame. He says, "If you did a survey of current serving members of the police force in this country, you'll be hard-pushed to find many who disagree with him." He says, "I know how the legal system works. I know how to beat the system." He says, "This is how you do it. And if about 10% of all drivers booked would follow my specific instructions, then the entire system would crash and become unworkable, to the extent that the government would have no choice but to stop issuing fines for every type of traffic offense. The whole lot of them, seriously." And again, we're just telling you this is all for information purposes only, but this is an ex-police agent telling you what he thinks you should do in regards to speeding or traffic fines or violations or tickets. He says, "I do not feel guilty about coming out with this information, as I think it's about time someone stood up for hardworking, civil-minded, law-abiding taxpayers in this country who are being screwed." He says, the former police sergeant goes on and says that it's very simple, very basic, that the idea is to clog up the system in the traffic camera office and the courts by drivers exercising their rights to remain innocent until proven guilty. He says, number one, do not accept the alleged offense. There are numerous valid reasons to dispute every single alleged offense. Often the charges are incorrect, or the evidence is illegally or incorrectly gathered. Then he says, number two, challenge it. Tell them that you are going to defend yourself on the matter. Make them earn their miserable $150 or $200 or whatever it is. They have to prepare evidence and witnesses. Just the wages for the camera operator or the policeman on the day of court would be more than the actual fine. You are taking a camera operator or a member of the police force off the street for a day. But it won't get to that point. And he says, read on. Number three, he says, if a court date is ever set and it does not suit you, do not accept it. Ask for a delay to a time and a place that suits you. Number four, when they are setting the date, delay it as often as possible. Keep pleading not guilty all through the process. He says you have every right to be sick or to go for an adjournment if the date does not suit for any legitimate reason. For example, you may have pressing family or work commitments which prevents you from attending a particular court or a particular day. Number five, he says, if it ever actually gets to court, which is unlikely if everybody would do this, and if you are unwell that day, call the court in the morning and tell them that you cannot make it as you are sick. He says that the operators, the camera operators, and the police and the prosecutors will already be at court, and it will be greatly inconveniencing to them by having to come back another day. And he says the whole time this is going on, the amount of work involved at the traffic camera office is huge. Several staff are involved. It rapidly becomes very costly, probably running into thousands of dollars. He goes on, number six. He says the court system is then placed under such a massive load by people who wanted their day in court that simply unless they open up another 50 magistrate courts. And this is obviously going to cost the government a lot more than the revenue raised. So if all the above fails, which is highly unlikely, he says, and you actually go to court and get convicted, he says, you have a right to appeal. He says, make sure you appeal the conviction. You don't need to be a rocket scientist to see what happens, he says. They are not going to spend millions chasing hundreds. And that's the bottom line, really, is about bogging the court system down where maybe they will have to back up, back off. Because he says, finally, number seven, tell everyone you know to challenge their alleged offenses. And the entire system would crash within a few weeks, he says. And he says, finally, number eight, he says, please pass this on. He says this in all capital letters in his writing. Always remember that you are innocent until proven guilty and that there is a very high probability that it's used against you is wrong. You have every right to challenge any alleged offense, and that is why the courts exist. They'll use them a lot. And again, legal advice, that's just strictly for information purposes only. That was a story I found over at the freethoughtproject.com by a former sergeant of the police force named Stan. So again, we went from seeing when the government police force is way out of control to secondarily the way that Stan, a former police sergeant, says that you can fight their being out of control. Now, if you think the police force are bad, wait till you get to the FBI. And that's the best way I know how to segue this other story that I'm going to read to you, because it does come from our folks at the Campaign for Liberty, a piece that they just put out in their national blog from this afternoon. And this is very disturbing to me, but it says that the FBI is hiring a firm to monitor and rate news stories on both the Federal Bureau of Investigation and law enforcement in general. And the story says, while it is unclear what the guidelines will be for rating news stories as quote positive or quote negative, this action should raise many, many concerns. Think about this for a minute. The FBI is hiring a contractor to grade news stories about the agency as positive, neutral, or negative, but they say the agency won't ever say what officials might get the information or what they plan to do with it. That's understandable, I guess, right? Not. FBI officials wouldn't even reveal how they would go about assigning the grades, which were laid out in a recent contract solicitation. The contract tells the potential bidders to, quote, use their judgment in scoring news coverage as part of a new daily news briefing service that the FBI is seeking as part of a contract that could last up to 5 years. You see how twisted this is? The move is reminiscent of a similar effort that the Obama administration made to grade media coverage of its response back in the BP oil spill. Anybody remember that all the way back in 2009? And then you had a separate defense contract rating reporters' work that was scrapped in 2009. So in a statement of work, the agency, the Federal Bureau of Investigation, now we're talking about the FBI as the agency, says that its public Affairs Office needs a contractor to help monitor, quote, breaking news, editorials, long-form journalism projects, and the larger public conversation about law enforcement. So you see, they wouldn't like the story that we just did a minute ago about all the abuse of power that went on in Berry Township, Michigan. They wouldn't like the story that we gave secondarily, where the former police sergeant told you what to do to fight your ticket. So both of our stories would have, I guess, been censored or been called unfair. I don't know how that would work out. But the lack of clear polling methods and goals raises some troubling questions, said Dan Kennedy, a journalism professor at Northeast University. No, really? Professor Kennedy says he would certainly worry that this could affect access. It might affect the way that you're going to approach your questions, whether they're going to be extra careful not to make news if you're on a, quote, bad list. And Mr. Kennedy also pointed out that journalism can be nuanced and complicated, raising questions about what sort of guidance the Federal Bureau of Investigation, the FBI, provides to contractors in order to fit stories into positive, neutral, or negative boxes. So if you're rigorously fair about it, and you're getting FBI's point of view out there, they would probably write that as a negative story. Isn't that exciting? Something to get excited about, your FBI monitoring your stories about police and the police force. We got that story out of the way. I got one piece left that kind of ties into all this very neatly, and it's talking about thinking and how apparently no one uses common sense. It's okay to abuse these people in Berry Township, Michigan. It's okay to try to give people all kinds of tickets and violations for revenue enhancement. And apparently it's okay for the FBI to use your tax dollars to then hire someone to monitor how you speak about police forces. Apparently that's all okay. And the final story, which you have to wonder from just hearing the previous, is from our good friend Thomas Sowell over at New American. And the headline of this piece put out today is Thinking Obsolete. And he says, Thomas Sowell does, that some have said we are living in a post-industrial era, while others have said that we are living in a post-racial era. And he says growing evidence suggests that we're just living in a post-thinking era. And he's being serious. He really is. And to go on, he talks about how many people in Europe and many people in the Western Hemisphere are staging angry protests about Israeli military action in Gaza. And I'm just reading Thomas Sowell's story. We're not going to get off on that big can of worms. But what he says was out of the talking points against Israel is that far more Palestinian civilians have been killed by the Hamas rocket attacks that started this latest military conflict. And Sowell goes on and says, are these protesters aware that the vastly more German civilians were killed by American bombers during Nazi Germany than American civilians killed in the U.S. by Hitler's forces? Talk show host Geraldo Rivera said that there's no way that Israel is winning the battle for world opinion, but Israel is trying to win the battle for survival while surrounded by enemies. Might that be more important? And that's where Thomas Sowell says, have any other country in any other way have they been expected to keep the enemy's civilians' casualties no higher than its own civilian casualties? And Thomas Sowell goes on and says that in an age where scientists are creating an artificial intelligence, too many of our educational institutions are creating artificial stupidity. So you got the computer scientists, the computer scientists in the labs defining maybe what's going to be a quote-unquote good child, and then you have these educated institutions that are creating artificial intelligence and artificial stupidity in the children. And Sowell said, Thomas Sowell says, it is much the same story in our domestic controversies. We have gotten so intimidated by political correctness that our major media outlets dare not call people who migrate to our country illegal immigrants. And we know that Geraldo Rivera over there on FAUX, as I call it, some people call it Fox News, he's denounced the Drudge Report for carrying news stories that show the negative consequences and dangers from allowing all these illegal immigrants, they're not little kids, but they're usually teenagers and young adults, to enter our country illegally and to be spread across the country by the administration. And Sowell says some of these youngsters are already known to be carrying lice and suffering from disease. Hell, we don't even know how many Ebola viruses are sneaking over the borders, because that has come out, how there are several potential Ebola cases, not just the two folks from Africa who were over there as missionaries or whatever, not just those being wheeled back over here to Atlanta. We're talking about other cases that have maybe been able to sneak in. And since there have been no thorough medical examinations of these people running across the border, we have no way of knowing whether or how many are carrying deadly diseases that will spread to American children when these unexamined illegal immigrants enter schools across the country. Now, that's scary. Now, the attack against Matt Drudge has been in the classic tradition of demagogues. It turns questions of the facts into questions of motive. Geraldo Rivera, a.k.a. Gerald Rivers, has accused Drudge of trying to start a, quote, civil war. Now, see, back when there were masses of immigrants coming from Europe into our country, guess what happened to the ones with dangerous diseases? They were turned back from Ellis Island. Go bye-bye. They were not allowed over. Nobody thought they had a legal or a moral, quote-unquote, right to be in this country, or that it was mean or racist to not let children catch these diseases. Even on the less contentious issue of minimum wage laws, Thomas Sowell says there are the same unthinking reactions. Although liberals, and he's using the modern term liberal, I don't like to use this false left-right paradigm, but we'll go with it. They're not classic liberals, or they believe in the Constitution, but they're modern liberals, or progressives, or socialists, or communists, or whatever you want to call them, or fascists. But Sowell says, although liberals are usually gung-ho for increasing the minimum wage, there was a sympathetic front-page story in the San Francisco Chronicle, July 29th, about the plight of a local nonprofit organization that would not be able to serve as many low-income minority youths if it had to pay a higher minimum wage. So guess what? Do they scrap the idea of raising the minimum wage, which is ridiculous? No. They want to now seek some type of exemption. It's the same thing we saw with the socialized healthcare program, whatever they want to call it, the AHA, the Obamacare, whatever you want to call it. They all of a sudden want to make all of us go by their stupid rules, and they want all kinds of exemptions so they can survive it. And this is what's happening, according to the San Francisco Chronicle article, about a local nonprofit there that could not serve all the poor minority kids if they had to pay the higher minimum wage. So what's going to give? Is it going to be the socialists and the union bosses who want this higher minimum wage because then it drives up other wages? Are they going to win out? Or is it going to be the nonprofits who are serving the poor little minority children? We know the nonprofits probably are not going to win out. There might be some type of exemption, I guess. That's what they're seeking. But does it not occur to these people that the very same thing happens when a minimum wage occurs within profit-based employers? They, too, tend to hire fewer inexperienced young people when there is a minimum wage law. Now, this is not breaking news. This is what has been happening for generations in the United States and in other countries around the world. One of the few countries without a minimum wage law is Switzerland. You want to know what the unemployment rate in Switzerland is? It's been consistently less than 4% for years. And back in 2003, The Economist reported that Switzerland's unemployment neared a five-year high of 3.9%. And we know that most recently, the Swiss unemployment rate is back down below 3%. Now, with a few minutes left, and I don't even know if I gave out the call-in numbers at the beginning of the show because we had so much news to cover, I believe that our good friend Paul from Stop It is ringing in. Paul, are you with us?
Good day. I heard minimum wage. That's one of our hot button issues, minimum wage. Dale, tell me what constitutes a fair minimum wage?
Oh, I think fair is a subjective term. I don't know, because I think a fair minimum wage would be one that's determined by the markets and the employers and not the government.
Well, in an ideal market economy, that would be the case, but we don't have a perfect market economy. But what is a number? What's one of the numbers that are being bantied about right now as a fair minimum wage?
Oh, we know in Louisville, they like nice, big, shiny, round numbers because they can't handle things that aren't round. So I think they've been talking about $10.10. Is that right?
$10. Well, see, that's interesting. If Louisville considers $10 a fair minimum wage,
mm-hmm.
up in New York City, they are talking about $15 as a fair minimum wage.
Well, things are more expensive out on the Eastern Seaboard. I agree with that. Mm-hmm.
Well, but the point is, if it's a fair minimum wage, if the issue is fairness, then why not $20 an hour? Why not $25 if it's a question of fairness?
Well, they want you to think that all these families are living off the minimum wage, Paul. We know, going back through history, if we look at any economics, that that's not true. If you go into these horrible cesspools called fast food restaurants, where what they serve is hardly even food, and it's not fast, if it's even delivered correctly at all by the non-English-speaking persons in the window, carrying God knows what disease they came across the border with, they're not raising full families on this minimum wage, but that's what they want you to think. And the union bosses love it, because then they can promote, oh, now our people have to get more money. But like you said, what is fair? I think that business in Louisville should to determine what it thinks fair, and I think a business in New York should determine what it thinks fair without the interference of the government.
You know, a few years ago, and I forget what the union was, but a few years ago we had one of the major national unions at their main headquarters actually have their office employees go on strike because they couldn't get the union to negotiate in good faith a new representation contract, which I found that hilarious, that a union office workers in a union organization couldn't come to terms with the management of the union
mm-hmm.
over working conditions and wages. Now,
well, that's kinda like,
don't you
right
think that is majorly hypocritical?
Oh, I know it is hypocritical, Paul, and it kind of reminds me of like when UPS back in the day was going through another threatened strike or standoff or walkout or whatever the proper term is. And I remember how UPS, in communicating all their threats of striking and causing production to come to a standstill, they weren't even sending their correspondence via UPS. They were sending it via the competition that is non-union, FedEx.
Well, they wanted it to get through.
They wanted it to arrive on time. Well, here's my question, Paul. In the few minutes that we have left, is it better to have a $10 or $15, whatever you want to call it, minimum wage, and have higher youth unemployment rates? Because all we hear about is when we have all this racial violence breakout, we have these racial riots in Louisville, and I'm not going to call it youth violence because I didn't see any face in that crowd that wasn't black, and I'm sorry, I don't do things politically correct here, and that's why the numbers are high on these shows, because they want to hear the truth. So when we had all this black violence in the city of Louisville back in the summer, so I guess if we raised minimum wage laws and there were even more black youth unemployed, that would be better somehow, Paul?
Well, you're hitting upon the right angle, but the people who run things, they know how to orchestrate and put on a show. So, you know, of course not. It's not going to favorably impact any type of youth, okay? It's not going to make them want to go to work. I don't think it's a dollars and cents issue ever. I really don't. If the kids want to work, they'll work. If the kids want to work, they'll work. Okay?
Well, the problem today
is,
Paul, if you go into these restaurants, and I use that term very loosely, these genetically modified food organism places where it takes a long time to get your order and it's overpriced because of the way the dollar's been devalued, and then people that you can't understand hand you the food out a window and it's barely even edible. The problem is you go to these places today and who's employed there? There's a lot of older people there who are employed, who couldn't retire and who are having to live off the pathetic government so-called Social Security, which we know is a scam. We'll keep calling it a scam. And there's a bunch of illegal immigrants and barely illegal immigrants working there. So you don't see a lot of these kids there. So because the older people are being forced back into the workplace and because the borders are wide open, surprise, surprise, there's not as many jobs for the young legal youth in the country, Paul. So how do these people who want a big minimum wage, how do they explain Switzerland? Yes, I do like Switzerland for a lot of what they do. It's too bad I can't speak the language well and migrate over there. But how do they explain the fact that Switzerland's unemployment rate is always around 3% with no minimum wage?
Well, but see, Dale, your question presupposes that the folks here in the United States really care about getting people into meaningful, and I'm going to use a union term, a living wage job. Because, again, as you pointed out, if all of these folks who are over here illegally were to leave tomorrow, by necessity, a number of those jobs would have to increase in value
yep.
in order to attract people to come in and do them. Now, the
yep.
employers always say, and having been in the real estate industry for a while, I used to hear a very common complaint from builders. Builders would always say that they had trouble finding good workers. My experience, though, was just the opposite. When you pay a good wage, you find good workers. So what the builders were actually saying is that they were too cheap to pay a decent wage, and therefore they didn't get the good workers that they claim weren't out there.
Yeah.
But other builders who paid better, they got the good workers and all the trades. So we got the same issue here. Anyone who says that we can't, that they can't find Americans to fill the various jobs, what that simply means is that they are not willing to pay a decent wage to attract good workers.
I agree with you, Paul. We're up against the end of the hour, so that'll have to be the last word on these ridiculous minimum wage arguments. But folks, there's a reason that businesses have to go out of business, whether it be the higher taxes, the Obamacare, the forced minimum wage increases, and businesses are not keen on that because I'm going to let you in on a little secret. Businesses are in business to make money. I know that's horrible. I know that's terrible. You want them all to be a non-profit. Hell, look what happened with a non-profit group that we just mentioned in San Francisco. The non-profit group couldn't afford to hire people if you raise minimum wage. So guess what? Even with non-profits, it doesn't work. So if you think that a worker has a right to a dignified wage, then you need to remember that the business owner has a right to profit from his business. So do not blame the business owner. Most are good people who want to pay a fair wage, but due to the Obamacares and the taxes and the regulations and the unemployment insurances and the Social Security and the FICA and the local and state and federal fees, they can't afford to do it. And if you want to blame the worker for wanting the fair wage he deserves, well, the business owner simply can't pay it. So if you take this wage, you don't have a union negotiating for you, but you take the wage, don't come back later and say you want more. You agreed to a set amount. I know this is old school because we're trying to tell you not to want to fault the government and the business owners. We understand there is not real free trade. There's not real free markets here at work. We understand it's a drag, but you've allowed the government to grow so big, and you've allowed the banksters to make the dollar worth so little, and now you're in the situation that you are. It's a fascist system. Your government is not a friend of the working class. The crony capitalists are hurting the poor. It is fascism. It is not socialism, and you need to make that distinction. Are you going to keep holding up your picket signs for worthless causes and say, oh, I want $10, $15, $20? Or are you going to stand up against the banksters and the institutions and the business owners who are part of the fascist order with the government? Or are you going to stand up to the subsidies at the very corporations that don't pay unskilled workers enough to live on? Are you going to stand up and fight the right force, or are you going to choose the wrong battles? You can be on the side of doing what they did in Iceland and put the banksters in prisons, or you can keep letting them put you in prisons. Are you going to side with the Republic, we the people, or are you going to be part of the New World Order? The choice is yours.
Well, they're here. I lock the door, but I can see them through the window. One of them is waving at me to shut down. I'm giving him the finger. I'll shut down when I'm goddamn good and ready.